from 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Coming up, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren takes a DNA test to prove her Native American ancestry.
I'm not enrolled in a tribe, and only tribes determine tribal citizenship. I understand and respect that distinction, but my family history is my family history.
But President Trump is unfazed.
Who cares? Who cares?
Will the test backfire? Our Week in Review panelists weigh in. Also today, the plan for a space force and what it might mean for Massachusetts.
There's a reason Raytheon is here. There's a reason why all of the major defense contractors have a presence in the Boston innovation economy.
Plus, the multi-city hotel worker strike that's affecting Boston. That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
What do we want?
Contract.
When do we want it?
Now.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Well, the fallout continues over Senator Elizabeth Warren's DNA test. Warren released a video Monday saying the test proves that she has Native American ancestry and disproves President Trump's criticism of her family lore.
Now, the president likes to call my mom a liar. What do the facts say?
The facts suggest that you
absolutely have a Native American ancestor in your pedigree.
But the test has provoked some strong criticism from both Republicans and Democrats, even from the tribe that Warren says is part of her heritage. The Cherokee Nation Secretary of State called Warren's DNA test inappropriate and wrong, and President Trump is now calling on Warren to apologize.
You owe her an apology? What about the money that I owe her?
She owes the country an apology.
Warren did express regret for not clearly making the distinction that only Native American tribes and not DNA tests determine tribal citizenship. And this is the first issue that we're going to take up with our Week in Review panelists this week. Charlie Chipio is a senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute and head of Chipio Strategies. Hello, and thanks for coming in.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Also with us, Arlene Isaacson, political consultant and co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. Hi there, Arlene.
Hi, Deborah.
So, obviously, strong backlash over this DNA test, probably not what Senator Warren expected. Arlene, was this a miscalculation by her campaign?
Well, you know, the truth is, I think this whole issue of people attacking her about her heritage is really appalling. It's an ad hominem attack. When you can't attack someone and win on the issues themselves, you go after the person. It's honestly a distraction from the main event. And the main event is, if you disagree with her policies, that's fine, that's fair, I can respect that. But to focus so much on whether or not the particular nature of her DNA makeup is, I find offensive at best.
But why take the bait?
Well, she has no choice because Trump's been putting it out there. And in the Trump era, distraction is the rule of the game. You know, I mean, the reality is that we all have family lore about who we are and where we came from. And we're all raised with stories that may or may not be true. But if you ever saw that television commercial for Ancestry.com where a guy stands there in lederhosen and says, I was raised to think we were German and now I found out we're Scottish, and he changes to a kilt. You know, you can't be blamed for what your family told you. And you have every reason and right to respect it and believe it.
Okay. Charlie Chipio, what do you think of this? Do you think that that she did this because she had to dispute what the president was saying?
Well, I think she felt like she had to. I guess I agree with Arlene. I just think it's such a sad commentary on where we've come. You know, I mean, I could see this whole thing, you know, being a one-day story after she claimed it a long time ago. But to, you know, hear that we are, what, a couple of years after this all started, that we're, you know, we're doing this. This is kind of like the birther thing. I mean, it's just...
Well, exactly, you know, which is what a lot of analysts are saying. She had to, because it is like the dispute over President Obama's birth certificate. Right. But so has this made it worse for Elizabeth Warren?
Has it made it worse? I mean, in what context? I mean, I don't think she's staying awake at night worrying about the Senate race coming up.
So is she worried about another race?
I think her chances of ultimately winning that race are about equal with her chances of losing this one.
Mm-hmm.
But sure, maybe she is. I mean, I would think that's what she's what she's thinking about. Yeah.
And let's talk about the tone. I know both of you say that you're dismayed by the tone of all of this and the fact that we're at this point where we're testing and what and who's calling who names and all of this. But I just want to point out that, let's say, the president had said in July that if she proved her ancestry, he would donate $1 million to charity. This week he said, no, he never said that. And then later he walked back and said he would donate the money, but he had a condition. Let's listen.
I'll only do it if I can test her personally. Okay, that will not be something I enjoy doing either.
So that was from the president, and this likely will continue to be an issue because we've heard Republicans are continuing to say that this isn't completely truthful about her ancestry. And, of course, there was all kinds of confusion and misreporting about what these tests meant, the genetics, the math. So I guess it's not going to go away. What's the best way to go forward?
Well, you know, one thing before answering that question is Trump's response to that I find a little bit misogynistic. All right, I'm being gentle. And, you know, but I'm not sure everyone has picked up on that.
Right.
It's kind of like that joke, that horrible statement he made about the commentator who was bleeding or something.
Oh, Megyn Kelly.
Let's not say it again.
Yeah. That's right. So that's threaded in a lot of his comments about this. And I think she had no choice. She had to deal with it. And it would be there whether she dealt with it or not, because he's not going to give up on his Pocahontas taunting. Mm. So she might as well just get the story out.
But did she have to do this to make a presidential run?
Yes. Unfortunately, really? I think she has to, because like with Obama's birth certificate, you just have to answer it. Otherwise, it goes on and on and on. Now, truthfully, I think it'll go on and on and on as well, no matter what.
Yeah.
But the notion that that Trump would back off the bet, I'm not shocked on the one hand, but people should be calling him on it. You made a bet. You'll give $100 million to charity. Do it.
Well, no, you're absolutely right about that. But again, I think what makes all this so complicated is because it's such a new world. I mean, this guy does things at least on a weekly basis, any one of which would have ended any other person's political career.
Yeah.
So this is such uncharted territory that I don't think we really know how to react to a lot of what he does.
Okay, well, just quickly, Arlene, Charlie gave us his thoughts about Elizabeth Warren's chances in 2020. Do you think it's a good idea for her to pursue the presidency?
You know, I'm really not sure. She certainly is qualified in the extreme for the position. The question is how misogynistic the voter base is.
Hmm. Really?
I think so. I think that played, just like racism played a part of Obama's campaign, though he was able to prevail against it. Misogyny certainly played a role in Hillary Clinton's. Not that some people, of course, voted against her no matter what, but there was a misogynistic component to it.
So a woman couldn't win?
No, I think a woman can. But I think the reality is that there's a misogynistic thread running through some of the voter base that we have to deal with. We have to learn how to deal with.
I think there are certain personality traits that a man could have and win, but a woman could not win with those traits.
Right. Yeah. And so does she have too many of those traits to win?
I think she probably does. And I don't mean that as a criticism against her. I'm just saying that as just an observation of what the political reality is out there.
Right. Well, let's move on to the governor's race here in Massachusetts. There was a debate this week between the two main candidates, Charlie Baker, Democrat Jay Gonzalez. And there's a big moment in this debate when Democratic gubernatorial candidate Jay Gonzalez asked Governor Baker about his promise to support the entire Republican ticket. So that, of course, includes Jeff Deal, who's a pro-Trump Republican running for Senate. Let's listen to this.
You going to vote for Jeff Deal?
Governor?
I'm going to vote for me, and I'm going to vote for Karen Pulido, and I'm going to vote for a series of other candidates as well. I don't know what I'm going to do yet with respect to that one.
You don't know if you're going to vote for the guy you endorsed?
I haven't made a decision.
Okay, it's a very uncomfortable moment there for Charlie Baker.
Cringeworthy.
Oh, yeah. Everyone was going, ooh. But, you know, his indecision didn't last very long. Right after the debate, this is what the governor said. He made up his mind.
I simply misspoke, but I'm going to vote for the ticket. And I think it's interesting that my opponent spent so much time talking about the U.S. Senate race and so little time talking about the race for governor.
Okay, Charlie Chipio, that gaffe, how big of a deal was that for Charlie Baker?
Well, I think it is important for Jay Gonzalez. I actually give Gonzalez credit because if you watched it, you know that, that they were sort of ending that session, with the moderators, and he sort of stopped and directly asked the governor, which I thought was very, very good move on his part. You know, I think it provides some attention to Jay Gonzalez, which perhaps he could use to sort of get some other ideas out there. I think in and of itself, I think for the most part, the only people who are really going to be affected or really riled up about that moment are probably the people who were likely to vote for Jay Gonzalez anyway. So I'm not sure that in and of itself is a big deal, but it certainly certainly gives him an opening.
I wonder what your take is, Arlene.
Well, as my teenagers used to say, awkward. So
it might still be.
I don't actually think he misspoke. I think he was. There was a deer in the headlights moment there. I suppose to his credit, he didn't want to lie. But I think he was genuinely torn. And it was smart of Gonzalez to go after him for that. Those of us who are in politics understand the nature of the beast is that you usually do have to, for a variety of reasons, political reasons, have to support the people in your party.
But let's talk about a little bit deeper, right? Because here's Charlie Baker, moderate Republican in Massachusetts, possibly, as all the polls, however these polls are determined, say most popular governor in the country, highest approval ratings, okay? That's how he is described. But has he really been a moderate Republican who has been able to encourage bipartisanship? And what does this say about sort of distancing himself from somebody who is a pro-Trump person?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think there's a lot of currents going on here. I think this is a very interesting dynamic. In Massachusetts, obviously, you know, we are to the left of the rest of the country, and I think that most folks think of the Republican Party here as being to the left of the National Republican Party. And I think in many ways it is. But what we saw in the primary was that the core of the Republican Party, who really comes out and votes in primaries and things like that, are very conservative. I don't mean to be blunt, although I usually am. A crazy person got 36% against him in the primary.
That's pretty blunt.
Yeah. So he's in a very difficult position. He needs... He needs the Republicans who voted in the primary.
Does he? I mean, that's my question.
He needs them to show up. I think he does need them to show up. I think he does need. And look, one thing we know to actually answer your question, you know, I think he has been very bipartisan. I give him credit for that. But I also think one thing we've seen about him is he's very cautious and he does not take anything for granted, and he has not up until now spent a lot of his political capital, and so I think that he's trying to walk a very fine line.
Do you think that Charlie Baker has to take a stand in any regard, Arlene, to win this election?
I mean, I wish he did speak out against the Jeff Deals of the world. But again, I consider it somewhat politically unrealistic just because of the nature of the political party system that we have here. I do give him credit for saying a year ago that he didn't vote for Trump. He is going to get any Republican who's a Trump voter who comes out to vote in November is going to vote for Charlie Baker. There's no question about that. Or the Scott Lively supporters. They'll hold their nose about, they may not agree with him on choice, but they'll vote for him anyway. And he needs to focus on the middle, the independents, and the moderates, and that's what he's done.
I think that's generally true, but I do think that he is concerned, whether he needs to be or not, we'll see, but I think he is concerned that a lot of those folks won't show up.
Gives them a reason. Yeah. Okay. Well, what might make people show up at the polls are these ballot questions, right? I mean, we've certainly got some very interesting, controversial ballot questions. Here on Radio Boston, we hosted two debates on the questions this week. The first was on question 3, which asks whether voters approve of the state law that bans discrimination based on gender identity in public accommodations. Now, a yes vote would keep the current law, a no vote repeal it. And on the show, we had Casey Saffredini, who's with Freedom for All Massachusetts, and he said a yes vote protects people's rights.
You know, we're all human beings. We're all neighbors. We're family members. We're friends. We're coworkers. And at the end of the day, we don't have to understand everything about each other to be able to treat each other decently and with dignity and respect.
And then we also spoke with Andrew Beckwith, president of the Massachusetts Family Institute, urging a no vote. He said this has nothing to do with transgender rights. It's about public safety.
Our concerns really have nothing to do with individuals who identify as transgender. It's the abuse, the potential abuse of this law by people who are predators.
Now, the campaign for question three has used some very controversial ads regarding this question. And I want to play part of a digital video ad that's urging a no vote on question three. And in this ad, a man enters a woman's locker room and hides. When a woman comes in, as the woman starts to get undressed, she realizes the man is in there. Let's listen to part of the ad.
What does Massachusetts question three mean to you? It means any man who says he is a woman can enter a woman's locker room, dressing room, or bathroom at any time, even convicted sex offenders. And if you see something suspicious and say something to authorities, you could be the one arrested and fined up to $50,000.
Yikes. So, Arlene, just wondering, what do you think of the ad and the debate on this question, which I think is public safety and human rights?
Well, I have a arguably unique perspective on this. I've been working on this issue for 10, 12 years, so I feel very passionately about voting yes to, and I think most fair-minded people will vote yes to protect trans folks. But the premise is simple, that their trans neighbor should be treated equally under the law with the same respect and dignity that anyone else in our community would deserve and want. You know, but it parallels what happened with the gay and lesbian community. In 1989, we passed the exact same bill that you can't discriminate in, based on sexual orientation and employment, housing, credit, and public accommodations. 20 years now, our opponents used the bathroom argument against us back then. 20 years later, the Trans Equal Protection Bill passes, and the exact same argument comes up, except this time it's about you can't discriminate based on gender identity in employment, housing, credit, public accommodations. What did the legislature do? They bifurcated the bill. They passed just the employment piece and the education piece and the housing piece, and they said, we'll wait on public accommodations. And a few years later, a year or so ago, they passed the bill saying you can't discriminate. 2 years ago in 2016. That you can't discriminate against trans people based on gender identity in public accommodations, which means hospitals and grocery stores and on public buses and in a theater. So the argument about safety is bogus, because the people who are screaming about safety now, they actually opposed it, opposed these protections when it had to do with employment, denying people jobs, and they use the same argument against us, the gay and lesbian community.
So why not go after the safety argument then, instead of just focusing on the human rights argument? Would that be a better way to do it?
Well, we actually did, and the campaign is doing that still. We made a point when lobbying the bill to show that the police supported the legislation, that women's groups supported the legislation, and that entities like Jane Doe that dedicate themselves to protecting women also supported the bill. And now they support us. They want to vote yes on question three as well. So we have the facts, but our opponents are using fear-mongering.
Mm-hmm. Charlie Sheffield, your thoughts on this campaign in particular?
Yeah, I mean, I think the other side, obviously, on this, you know, they it's their right to bring it to the ballot and go through this. But, you know, in a perfect world, this has no place on the ballot. You know, this has been debated thoroughly, and it has, you know, and the legislature has acted on it, and the bill was signed into law. You know, since that happened, I haven't seen any sort of horrible things that have happened. And I guess to bring it to a very personal level, I spend a lot of time worrying about my 15-year-old daughter, but this does not make me worry. You know, I just don't really see an issue here.
Okay, well, I now have to end with our hubbubs here. And these are the brief stories or events that have caught our attention this week. That's all we have time for, unfortunately. So let's do these hubbubs. Arlene, your hubbub.
Oh, well, my hubbub is about Halloween, that it's not just for kids anymore. The Beacon Hill Times recently listed reminded people of the street closures that will take place on Halloween so that trick-or-treaters can walk in the street without cars and traffic. Mm. And in fact, many neighborhoods are now finding that the adults are getting into Halloween, whether they have kids or not, whether they just hang out on their porches and their decks and their city stoops and as they give out candy and dress in costumes. And Halloween has become a great opportunity to get to meet and to know your neighbors. You know, sometimes people know each other because they share kids in common, or they know each other because they all have dogs and they go to the dog park together. But even with the people that you may disagree with politically, you can enjoy and appreciate each other as neighbors, at least for a few hours, on Halloween. We can all benefit from it.
Because you're wearing a mask.
Exactly.
Because you're being nice to everyone, and you're enjoying each other, and you're enjoying the holiday. We all benefit because it creates a common ground with neighbors, and so I actually believe Halloween can help make the world a better place, even if it's just for one day a year.
All right. Very nice hubbub. Charlie, what's your hubbub?
I thought you were going to different. I thought you were getting something about how it's a night for the parents to get together and somehow avoid the kids.
That happens too.
Well, for those of you who've been wondering what goes on at U.S. embassies around the world, here's a report from our embassy in Australia. There, an unknown number of people mistakenly received an email invite to a cat pajama party last week. The invitation featured a cat lying back on a couch in an electric blue Cookie Monster costume with a plate of cookies on its fuzzy belly. Turns out it was a training error made by a new staff member testing out the embassy's email newsletter platform, and the embassy will be introducing, quote, strong new management controls to ensure that there is no repeat of this high-level diplomatic gaffe. But it appears that the party has taken on a life of its own. New Zealand's embassy is among those.
Scott Brown, we should
say. No, but I think it's actually the New Zealand's embassy to Australia.
Okay.
I was hoping there was going to be a local angle to this.
No local angle here. Okay, so we should say Scott Brown is. Okay,
but New Zealand's embassy is among those who will attend a virtual online celebration of the pajama cat party.
All right, very nice. Well, for my hubbub, I'm going to start with a question to both of you. Did you buy a Mega Millions ticket? $1 billion jackpot, I just want to point out. And I'm told that tickets today are selling at a rate of $3,000 a minute.
Oh, my
right
gosh.
Now. So I'm wondering, guys, did you miss this? Did you miss the Mega Millions ticket?
I keep losing with lottery tickets, but the biggest problem is that I forget to buy them.
Yeah.
You definitely lose that way.
I have a strange perspective on this. I want like a $2 million lottery win so that I'm sort of below the radar. I don't have all these hassles that come along with the world going after you and try to scam you.
$1 billion
kind of scares me a little bit.
Yeah, like the New Hampshire winner
who sued first and
asked for anonymity before she would accept the jackpot. Well, for this, I actually have a guest for my hubbub, and I'm allowed to do this, right? So I have
this show is
a math expert, right, to help us understand the odds here because we're talking about 3,000 tickets a minute being sold, which we found incredible. So we asked George Reck, the director of the Math Resource Center at Babson, to come on the show in just for about a minute or so. Hello, Professor. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi. Thank you very much.
So these Mega Millions odds here are 1 in 300 million or so. That doesn't sound very good. Just briefly, tell us, what does the math behind those numbers suggest?
Well, it basically, the math is a series of all the different combinations of the way you could draw the numbers. And so, you know, there are probably syndicates out there trying to put together groups and groups of people to try and capture every number on the hope of winning.
Mm-hmm.
But think about how long it would take to do that.
Right. Sounds like an awful lot of work and a lot of money. And they also actually changed the odds not that long ago to make it even harder for people to win, so the jackpots would get bigger. So from a math perspective, I'm wondering, with those kinds of odds, what's your advice here?
Well, the advice is simple. You're not likely to win.
Mm. Right. Well, we knew that.
But the risk is very low. I mean, one of the things we teach here is risk and reward. When you're only risking $2 for a ticket, you're not putting yourself out that much. You know, it's a cup of coffee. It's a candy bar at the vending machine, which actually I just got a few minutes ago. It was almost $2 for a candy bar. Skip your candy bar, buy a lottery ticket.
Yeah, but still, it's like throwing it away. At least you get to eat the candy, right?
That's true, but there's entertainment value. Plus, I heard earlier you were talking about things that might unify people. This is probably one of the number one social topics out there, and everybody seems to have a positive attitude about it, talking about what they would do if they had the money to, if they won the money.
What would you do?
Take my wife on a long-awaited honeymoon somewhere. First class all the way.
Oh, nice. Very nice. Arlene, what would you do? Don't know?
No, I agree with what was said a short while ago. The I'd be happy to win a mere $2 million.
A mere $2 million. Exactly. But what, Charlie, what if you did win?
I have endless wanderlust, so travel would be
travel.
The
there
first,
you go.
See? My first priority.
All right. Well, I think that George Reck was right. It brought all of us together. Well, good luck. Good luck, and thank you, George Reck, director of the Math Resource Center at Babson College. Thank you.
You're very, very welcome.
Also, Charlie Chipio, senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute and head of Chipio Strategies. Thanks to you.
Thank you.
Arlene Isaacson, political consultant and co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, the plans for a space force to be part of the U.S. military and what that might mean for Massachusetts. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Our next conversation might sound like science fiction, but it's not. The U.S. government is currently working on creating a so-called space force. Earlier this year, President Trump said he wanted to create a new branch of the military dedicated entirely to fighting in space.
You know, I was saying it the other day because we're doing a tremendous amount of work in space. I said, maybe we need a new force. We'll call it the Space Force. And I was not really serious. And then I said, what a great idea. Maybe we'll have to do that. That could happen.
For more on this Space Force and what it might mean for Boston, we're joined by reporters Anindya Nwameka from WBUR's Bostonomics team. Her story about this was on WBUR's Morning Edition today. Hi there, Anindya. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Deb.
So, Space Force, what would this look like?
Yeah, so this would actually be an entirely separate branch of the military with its own mission. So Trump has already ordered the Pentagon in August, actually, to start establishing a Space Force. The plan includes a few points. So creating a U.S. Space Command by the end of this year, that would be led by a four-star general, and the role would be to prepare for conflict in space. Another part of this would be creating a space development agency that would create new technology for a Space Force. There would also be a space operations force, and that would be a group of space technology and warfare experts. They would eventually become the core part of an eventual Space Force military branch. And then the last part would be to submit to Congress a legislative proposal to create a Space Force as part of the Pentagon's 2020 budget request.
So are we talking about soldiers and weapons in space?
So, you know, this is where a lot of people's minds go. When you hear Space Force, that's really the image that comes to mind. But that's not what we're talking about. What the administration has outlined is really a reorganization of the military, where they are looking to pull together into one new branch all of their space operations. I spoke to Laura Grego of the Union of Concerned Scientists about this. And, you know, she said the physics just don't work very well for weapons in space. And she said soldiers really wouldn't be useful there. But she and others, you know, are concerned that a space force would lead to more aggressive military action in space.
It does sound like it's opening the door or encouraging more weaponization. I mean, it's called Space Force, not Space Corps or Space Coast Guard.
So she thinks resources should go elsewhere, so really more focused on science and innovation and not more militarization of space. At this point, it's not clear how much it would cost, but a Space Force would certainly be in the billions of dollars.
So you mentioned conflict in space. Is there reason for the U.S. to be concerned about what's happening? Have there been threats?
Well, U.S. intelligence officials certainly think there is reason to be concerned. Intelligence officials earlier this year reported that Russia and China are pursuing non-destructive and destructive counter-space weapons for use during a potential future conflict. So that's the latest in a series of intelligence threat assessments that have expressed concern over China's activity in space. And that actually dates back to the Bush administration. One of the worries is really about anti-satellite weapons, which intelligence officials say Russia and China could have operational very soon in the next few years. So the Trump administration sees Space Force as a part of a national security strategy. He called space a warfighting domain, just like land, air, and sea.
And your story this morning mentioned GPS devices that most of us can probably relate to. Are there other ideas about how to secure the technologies that we rely on that are in space?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. When we talk about space assets like satellites, we're really talking about digital devices in a lot of ways. And some people I spoke to said that they would like to see cybersecurity be a big part of a space force. But others said we shouldn't even be focusing on creating a space force right now. We should really be creating a cyber force. I spoke to Gregory Falco. He's a cybersecurity researcher affiliated with Harvard, MIT, and Stanford. He's really looked at this stuff. And he says Russia and China likely aren't going to be shooting down our satellites, but they're much more likely to hack them, to steal data, or to alter the data in some way.
Now, they already have tricked our satellites. They've already done things that have caused irreparable damage to these systems. The threat's going to get worse, absolutely. But, I don't think that we can even start thinking about what a space force could look like until we start thinking about how we digitally secure the assets that we already have up there that would enable such a space force.
Yeah, and one thing I want to make clear is, everyone I talk to really agreed that it is important to protect our military assets in space. The question and where some people differ is how to go about doing that.
And what does this mean for Boston?
Well, space is already big business for many companies around here. That will continue no matter how the military is structured, likely, and if there's a new Space Force branch. But of course, more military spending in space could be quite lucrative for a lot of the companies here. We're a major hub for technology and research. So if a Space Force happens, many of the institutions here will likely be a part of that. I spoke with Tufts professor Rockford Weiss about that.
There's a reason Raytheon is here. There's a reason why all of the major defense contractors have a presence in the Boston innovation economy. We have people here who have done this stuff and who would, I think, respond favorably and very capably to an enhanced focus by the military to increase both our offensive and defensive capabilities in the outer space operating realm.
And as I mentioned, that work is already underway to get a Space Force going. We'll have to wait and see, though, if Congress moves to make it a new branch of the military. That hasn't happened since the Air Force became a separate branch in 1947.
Now, ideas like this have been around before, been talked about before. Put this proposal in a bit of context for us.
Yeah. So, the idea for a Space Force isn't new. It's been around for years. Space has been mentioned in national defense strategy documents. Space is definitely a component that the military has been looking at. Concerns around defending space assets have also been around for a while. In 2001, then Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld led a commission to explore space-based weapons, and they recommended that the Air Force take steps to create a space culture rather than treat it as secondary to its air mission. And I should note that right now the military's space operations currently fall under the Air Force, but of course this idea of a space force would bring that entirely into its own separate branch.
So is this something that might really happen?
Well, it's real, and it's really happening, at least in some ways. The Trump administration is taking steps, as I mentioned, to get Space Force going. Of course, it's up to Congress to approve a new branch of the military. The administration is hoping that happens by 2020, but really, it could take much longer for an official military branch called Space Force to be created.
All right. WBUR Bostonomics reporter Zanin Joran-Wameka. A link to her story is available at our website, radioboston.org. Zaninja, thanks so much for coming in.
Sure thing, Deb.
In case you missed it last night, the Boston Red Sox won the American League Championship Series, defeating the Houston Astros and advancing to the 2018 World Series, which starts next week. But before the series, there's another major Boston sporting event that launches tomorrow, the 54th Head of the Charles Regatta. Nearly 11,000 athletes from around the globe will row up the three-mile course on the Charles River, and hundreds of thousands of spectators are expected to stand along the shore to cheer them on. WBUR's Hannah Shenatry introduces us to the volunteers working behind the scenes.
Rowers up and down the Charles are preparing for the race. They launch their boats before the sun is up, with bow lights casting red and green on the bridges they pass in the dark. Oars skim just above the surface before prying through the water. Coaches bark orders, telling groups of 8 and 4 to bring the pressure up. Push harder. Go faster. Drive. This weekend, in front of hundreds of thousands of spectators, rowers find out if they worked hard enough. The Head of the Charles is a bucket list race for rowers, from high school to college to veteran rowers in their 80s.
We are the largest two-day regatta in the world. It is a head race, meaning each boat goes off one at a time.
Courtney Wilson is one of two race directors for this year's regatta. Unlike Boston's other major race, the Boston Marathon, there is no purse or prize money for first place in the championship events. For every race, the prize is bragging rights and a medal.
It's such an iconic, amazing event. You know, the rowing is wonderful. It's beautiful. It's rower Christmas.
Every Christmas story needs a Santa Claus. And at the Head of the Charles, that role is filled by volunteers, nearly 2,000 of them. There are only 5 paid full-time staff members, so the volunteers do most of the work, managing almost every aspect of the race. Volunteer Karen Lai organizes backup timing at the finish line.
Do you have what you need? Do we have the equipment that we need? Do we have, you know, computers, tables, chairs? You know, all the stopwatches that need to be synced? Have their batteries been changed?
The volunteer positions are coveted by both rowers and non-rowers, and that makes it competitive to get a spot.
Unfortunately, you know, we do have to turn people away because it's so popular.
Race officials estimate about 40% of all applicants are turned away. Some of the crunch is due to a need for specialized skills. There are restrictions about who is eligible to run the starting line, and volunteer umpires have to know the race rules. But some of the tight demand is because of repeat volunteers. John Bourne has been volunteering for the majority of the race's existence.
I think this is my 38th year. I've been doing it for so long, it's just part of my life. To miss out on it would be terrible.
Not everyone don't want to go on the spot. Hang on.
Bourne is working on the dock team this year. He's helping corral the groups of college students who build the extra docks needed to support the influx of boats on the river. The students drag heavy sections of dock down the bank towards the river, bolting them together into a floating mass 180 feet long. On this day, it's raining. But for Caleb Wilson, a sophomore at Boston College, it's worth spending a day in the mud.
Boston's our city. You know, we'd do anything to make the race of Boston a little bit better.
That love of the race is what drives most volunteers. Though, to be fair, they do get Brooks Brothers race jackets. For Karen Lai, who's been volunteering for 10 years despite only rowing for one, coming back is a point of pride.
It's hard to put into words, but it's just one of those things that it's so Boston, and, you know, people love New England for the fall, and I just feel like it's this like shared experience that you have in Boston.
For other repeat volunteers and athletes, the words come easily. In Boston, Christmas comes twice a year.
That was WBUR's Hannah Shenatry. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. That's the sound of striking workers at Boston's Westin Copley Hotel today. The strike is now in its third week, with the main issue being pay, benefits, and scheduling. Tommy Ivory has worked at the Westin Copley for 34 years, and he says he hopes to go back to work soon.
I like to see that things come to a conclusion. We don't need to go as long as 3 or 4 weeks. Hopefully, both sides can come to a conclusion, say, I'm willing to sign it and get it done. And I wanted to fix it for all us middle-class people who are trying to get by.
Joining us to talk about this strike is Carlos Aramayo, Financial Secretary Treasurer of the Hotel Workers Union Unite Here Local 26. Welcome, Carlos.
Yeah, welcome. Glad to be here.
So tell us, we've got more than 1,000 workers on strike in Boston. A lot of folks picketing, pounding drums down by the Westin Copley. How much, you know, what are the big, I think, obstacles here, the big things that are getting in the way of a contract?
Yeah, there are 1,500 Marriott workers who are currently on strike in Boston, and that's part of 7,700 workers on strike across the United States in San Francisco, Hawaii, San Diego, various other places. And the slogan of the campaign is one job should be enough. If folks look around the city of Boston, I've lived here for a long time, you can see that the cost of living in the city has increased. And working people, working class people, a lot of folks from communities of color who work in our city have been pushed outside of the city. Mm. They can't make ends meet with one job anymore. They can't live here. I think the Boston Foundation recently published a study talking about how the middle class is shrinking, and there are real challenges for folks to pay rent, to be able to retire with dignity, and to be able to live here in this city.
Wages.
Yeah, yeah.
Wages,
it makes a big difference.
Wages are the big issue. Yeah. So that's the issue that we're talking about here, right?
Yeah, wages. And I think as part of that, it's really about income. And there's two parts of income. One is wages, and folks definitely want to see their wages increase. And the second thing is this prevalent nature of part-time jobs. And lots of jobs that used to be full-time jobs, jobs like hotel housekeeping, there's been a lot of cuts that are taking place by companies like Marriott that have really taken people off the schedule. People with 10, 15 years of seniority are sleeping with the phone by their pillow to see if they get called in the next day.
I read that sort of green choice program where folks can decide if they want their towels washed or their linens washed. That actually has meant that the hotels, what they've done in exchange is then told people that we may not need you. So that's why they're on an on-call basis instead of a regular schedule. And so that's an issue.
That's right. Yeah. No, the green choice program, which, you know, I think is a bit of a greenwashing program, is a real issue. And I think a lot of customers don't know, and I think people are trying to do the right thing. They're trying to say, hey, I want to take care of the environment, and that's great. I think a lot of folks don't know that the consequence of that is that Marriott is taking folks off the schedule, and they're staying at home. They're not being able to make the income that they need to live in the city, and we got folks moving to New Hampshire, moving to New Bedford, moving to Fall River, folks getting pushed out of the city.
When these workers that we're talking about that are represented by Local 26, what's the average wage?
Yeah, so folks make a real range of wages, and it depends on the job category folks have. You know, folks make as little as, you know, the folks in the gratuitied parts make, you know, $7 an hour, $8 an hour. Folks can make up to $20, $21 an hour in these jobs. But as I said, in some ways, it doesn't really matter what your hourly wage is. Mm. If there has been a systematic cutting back of the number of hours folks have, folks' annual incomes are declining in a city where the cost of living is increasing.
But I wonder how much longer people can go without a paycheck.
Yeah, look, it's been really amazing. I think you heard a little bit of it at the Westin in the little clip you played. Folks' spirits are still high, and folks are determined to get this resolved and to be able to move forward in terms of their income, in terms of being able to have one job be enough. And, you know, folks are, we've been raising money from the general public. A lot of folks have been contributing to our strike assistance fund, which has really been amazing. And then a lot of folks are really just helping each other out, right? Obviously, a lot of folks have different financial situations. Some people better, some people more difficult, but folks are really working together to stay on strike and to stay strong. And our picket lines have been strong for, you know, we're in the third week now, and we still got thousands of people coming out every day.
What about negotiations? I understand a federal mediator is involved. What's happening?
Yeah, the lines of communication are open, and I think we want to be clear about that. You know, we're not kind of taking a our way or the highway approach to this. We do have lines of communications open with the company. There is a federal mediator involved. And, you know, we really hope that as this, I think, crisis for Marriott has grown in multiple cities, that the company will come to the table, will present reasonable proposals to resolve our, I think, modest demands, and help people move forward. I think you heard that in the clip you heard.
Right.
You
know. Briefly, what are the demands? You said wages. You said, you know, total compensation, regular schedules. I mean, just very briefly, because we don't have a lot of time here. But if you could say what's the main, you know, one or two demands?
Sure. Income makes a big difference. Number two.
Income means a percentage of. I understand that income is an issue, but are you talking about a percentage for all of these workers or?
Yeah, I think, as I said, a lot of folks make their money in different ways in this mm-hmm. industry. Everyone needs their income to move forward to be able to live in this city where the cost of living has increased. That's the number one issue. Number two is retirement. A lot of our folks can't retire because they can't afford health coverage when they retire. And we have housekeepers who are 75, almost pushing 80 years old, still working on the floors.
So you're asking for like a 401k plan for these?
No, for something to allow them, we have a pension, but something that could boost the pension to allow some of these more senior employees to be able to retire to cover the cost of the Medicare Part C and things like that, and so that when they retire.
Okay, I want to turn now to someone who can talk a little bit about this in general. Bob Forint is on the line. He's a labor historian and professor at UMass Lowell. Hello, Professor.
Good afternoon.
So what do you think this Marriott strike symbolizes in terms of a labor action?
In terms of putting it in some historical context, it's not unlike strikes of the 1930s or even the early 20th century, when workforces that were unorganized and or low-waged began to figure out how solidarity across different hotels, in this case, or auto plants or steel mills or woolen mills in Lawrence in 1912, are able to figure out how do we create unity and move our lives forward. And when I listen to the issues and the demands, it reminds me of other strikes I've either written about or studied across much of the late 19th, early 20th century.
But when we've got a national grid strike going on, that's been going on for weeks, and now we've got this hotel strike that's been going on for weeks, I wonder, what does this say about the employers that are allowing this to go on for weeks? And especially these hotels, it looks as if you believe TripAdvisor reviews, there are lots of people complaining on TripAdvisor about what's happening at some of these hotels. So they have a real chance to lose some revenue here because of this. Why are the employers seemingly allowing these to drag on?
I think employers in general have been emboldened around the country, really, to think this is a vulnerable time for workers and unions. We've had the recent Janus Supreme Court case decision on public workers. There have been a whole host of other efforts to try to create more right-to-work states and other things. And the climate is such that I think it gives them the idea that they can be far more aggressive. It's actually pretty strange because we have a fairly tight labor market, and if workers who are on strike or locked out at National Grid find other jobs, then, you know, these companies are going to end up behind the eight ball because they're just not random crowds of workers around. And hotel workers have a skill, have a trade, and it's not something someone's going to pick up off the street in 45 minutes to an hour. So it's penny wise and pound foolish in the end, but I think they do think they can be aggressive now just because of the tenor at the top of the country that's just very clearly anti-labor union.
Mm. How significant is this strike in particular for the hospitality industry, would you say?
I think it's huge because this is in many ways an example sort of like Ford Motor Company back in the 1930s. Workers tried to figure out, okay, well, where's a real key player in the automobile industry? And if we can crack that one, if we can get better wages and benefits and union recognition, you know, then this is going to bode well for workers across the board. And so Marriott's been incredibly profitable. They've been buying other hotel chains. It's not like they can plead poverty. And so they're a key actor. And if Local 26 is able in Boston and then the other locals around the country are able to be successful, it sends a good message to other hotel workers in other places. And it may actually lead some hotels to just settle rather than take a strike because they'll see the handwriting on the wall.
We should say we have a statement from Marriott. Just to paraphrase it here, it says, "We respect the right of our associates to voice their opinions, but we will welcome back any associate who chooses to return to work, and we are working to get this resolved as quickly as possible." So that's what Marriott says about this. But I wonder, we've got some big events coming up here. We found out that the Red Sox are going to the World Series. We've got the head of the Charles Regatta that we just heard about on this show. We're going to need a lot of hotel rooms. How do you think that Boston will fare? And we've only got a few seconds here. How do you think Boston will fare with those big events and this strike going on? What would you say, Mr. Forn?
I would hope that the people who might be thinking of staying in the struck hotels don't do what the New York Yankees did. And I'm going to figure that the New York Yankees crossing the picket line, they're now cursed.
All right. Bob Forrant, labor historian and professor of history at UMass Lowell and apparently a Red Sox fan. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Also, Carlos Aramayo, Financial Secretary, Treasurer of the Hotel Workers Union Unite here, Local 26. Thanks so much.
Thanks very much.
I'm Deborah Becker. Have a good weekend. This is Radio Boston.